If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. During its heyday in the Roaring Twenties, Cairo's nightlife district was the place to go for a world-class night out. From glitzy variety shows in smoky clubs to Arabic operas performed to adoring, raucous audiences, it was a scene suffused with both glamour and danger, and dominated by a group of canny, enterprising women. Raphael Cormack delves into this world in his new book, Midnight in Cairo, and I spoke to him to find out more. Can you set the scene for us? So if we travelled back to Cairo's nightlife district in its heyday, what are some of the sights and the smells and the sounds that we might encounter?
So the heyday, really, the golden age of Cairo's nightlife was the 1920s. Probably that's, you know, it had been existed a bit before then and carried on a little bit after, but that was the peak. And it was all centered around this district in the middle of Cairo called Esbekeia, which was itself all built around these big gardens, which had been laid out in the 19th century by the ruler of Egypt, the Khedive Ismail. He'd actually brought in the guy who did the Bois de Boulogne in Paris and laid out these very nice gardens that people were supposed to walk around. He'd built it up in a sort of very fancy style. He'd built his opera house, modeled kind of on La Scala in Milan. He'd also built another theater and a circus. And he was really trying to turn it into a kind of quite elite, often, you know, European-inspired entertainment area. But, you know, as people went, various other things, you know, sprang up around it. So people opened up bars, people opened up music halls, which were slightly less kind of salubrious than what the ruler had imagined they would be, you know, smoky places with dancers and, you know, drinking until late in the night. People also started opening up their own independent theatres and cabarets. And what you would have seen sort of on a night out in 1920s Cairo was a huge mix of things, you know, from this opera house to cabarets run by Europeans who had come to Egypt and done in a kind of Parisian style, and then on to more Egyptian style cabarets where everything was in Arabic, people, you know, dancing, singing, variety shows. There was kind of a little bit of everything for everyone. What struck me most is you see so many women in charge of these places, from cabarets to theatres to everything. And it's kind of a thing that you're not told happened in early 20th century Egypt, but it's sort of there everywhere.
So we'll talk a lot more about those women a bit later. But I think that a lot of our listeners, especially in the US and the UK, might not be that familiar with what was going on in Egypt at the time. So can you give us a bit of historical background?
So what happened in 1919, which is the most important piece of historical background we really need for this, is a big revolution in Egypt. So before 1919, the country had been run in various levels of direct rule and indirect rule for a few decades by the British. The First World War is when the British really officially took over Egypt, and they kind of, drained a lot from the country, both by making men join in with the war effort, which usually didn't mean fighting, but meant joining a labor corps, and by requisitioning food and livestock and everything. So the country was kind of really hurting at the end of the First World War, and was in the control of the British, and people were starting to kind of resent that. So in 1919, when the Paris Peace Conference happened, the Egyptians decided that they were going to send some representatives in order to, you know, join this new community of nations as an independent nation by themselves. But the British decided that they didn't think that was a good idea, and they, in fact, arrested and exiled these Egyptian sort of nationalist leaders who were trying to vie for independence. And once they had done that, the people, I mean, because of this sort of build up over the decades of resentment towards British rule, rose up, took to the streets. It's kind of this, in the Egyptian telling of it, it's a very carnivalesque atmosphere, you know, national unity, everyone's out in the street, including lots of theater performers and cabaret stars, actually, would come out, sing songs, and sort of face up to the British. In the British telling of this, it's very different. They see it as kind of fanaticism, and they responded with quite a lot of violence. But eventually, it was successful. In the early 1920s, Egypt becomes an independent country with various strings attached, which continued to be an issue until the 1950s. But Egypt is in the 1920s an independent country, and it has this real sense of both sort of national unity and a sense that things might be getting better. And that's definitely something we need to think about when we're looking at all this nightlife and entertainment, that there was behind it all, there's this real sense of optimism.
Yeah, so how did this kind of melting pot of influences play out in a nightlife sense? So you mentioned there were a lot of European influences, but were there other international influences at play as well? And what was the kind of Egyptian element of this nightlife culture?
Yeah, I mean, Egypt in the 1920s was the most, so everyone says, one of, if not the most cosmopolitan countries in the world, and Cairo, the most sort of cosmopolitan cities in the world, except perhaps Alexandria. So Egypt in the 1920s, Cairo in the 1920s, is this place that's attracting a huge number of different people from Eastern Europe, from Western Europe. It's kind of a boom town. Kind of people joke that it's the Dubai of the 1920s. In fact, the British presence, although politically is very important, culturally is sort of not that significant. I mean, the French presence is much more influential in terms of culture. But people are coming also from Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, what is now, and also a lot of people coming from Eastern Europe. And they're all thrown together in this nightlife district. If you would look at a chorus line in an ordinary nightclub, there would be, you know, Hungarians, Greeks, Italians, Egyptians, Syrians, French, all of it.
You tell the story of this nightlife culture primarily through the stories of women who were the stars of the scene. Why did you want to focus on women particularly?
I think there's two reasons for that. One, which we sort of mentioned already, which is that these stories are not often seen in your sort of the impression people often get of the 1920s in Egypt or sort of the early 20th century is that it's a very male-dominated place. And that's true in the case of politics, for instance. You know, high politics, at this time, women don't have the vote, for example. So, and basically do not participate really significantly in high politics. But when you leaf through the pages of the entertainment magazines, they're everywhere. And I sort of wanted to delve into that and try and bring out what that means for, you know, historically. So that's the first reason. And the second reason is just that I feel it gives a very unique way of looking at the nightlife period. So, I mean, I've been fascinated by that, the whole Cairo nightlife of the 1920s for a while. But to use women as a way to get into it, I think shows both the great opportunities that it had. So, I mean, a lot of these women grew up very poor, had very little education, but managed to, through this nightlife scene, managed to really become independently wealthy, become independent, you know, in their lives, and really progress in sort of amazing ways. So looking at this nightlife through the women allows you to see that, you know, the opportunities that it had, but it also allows you to see downsides and some of the darker sides of the nightlife, because for every woman who became very successful, there's another one who didn't.
Mm. So what kind of roles were women taking on in this nightlife scene? Because they weren't only dancers and chorus line girls, for example, were they?
No. I mean, so one of the central women in this book is called Badia Masabni. And she had an extremely eventful life before even coming into the nightlife scene. She was, you know, born in Damascus, was the subject of sexual abuse as a child, which she sort of hints at but doesn't give many details of. Then the family moves to Buenos Aires and then comes back. She ends up in Cairo eventually as an actress, then moves to Beirut to become a singer. She's like constantly moving around the world, basically. But where we sort of join her is the peak of her career, which comes in the mid-1920s, when she managed to save up the money that she's made acting, singing, and all the rest of it, and opens her own nightclub, which then became the great Arabic-speaking nightclub, possibly the great nightclub of Cairo's 20s and 30s, and kept going at it, including into the Second World War, when it was the destination to go to for all British soldiers during the Second World War.
Do we have any sense what a night out there would have been like?
We've got quite a lot of accounts of evenings at Padilla's club. She had two different clubs. She had a summer club and a winter club. The summer one was down by the Nile, where there was kind of a breeze blowing through open air, and it would sort of alleviate somewhat the heat of Cairo's summers. And then the winter club was downtown in this Esbekeia area. And, I mean, she was famous for bringing in acts from all over the world. She would travel around, go to Europe, go to Spain, go to Syria, and bring people. So a night at her club was a real mix of acts. She would always sing and dance. And then she would have, I mean, what is essentially a sort of variety floor show of the 1920s. You'd have singers and dancers, of course, with a musical backing, but you would also have sort of weightlifters and this thing called a quick change artist, who these people who would change costumes and sort of do different little impressions all the time. She had one Italian troupe come through where a man impersonated a frog. She describes him sort of writhing around on the floor. It's quite hard to picture what's going on. So that's the acts that she would put on, like extremely varied. As for sort of what it would be like to go, it would last pretty late into the night. There'd be a lot of champagne, probably other kinds of drinks, a pretty raucous atmosphere. It's pretty fair to say that it would be largely male on most most nights. Interestingly, she put on female-only matinees, which would be, it would be the same basic performance, but it was for women who wanted to come to a cabaret show, but perhaps not have this sort of late-night raucous atmosphere dominated by men. And also that she had a section for women only, if they wanted to come. But the general sense is that the late-night entertainment was quite raucous and masculine in its atmosphere.
See, it all sounds incredibly exciting and glamorous, but you did mention earlier that there's obviously a darker side to this. And what were some of the objections to this nightlife scene, or what criticisms did people level against it?
Well, I mean, there were the usual criticisms that you expect from pretty much all nightlife scenes, which are it's kind of leading the youth of the nation astray. People are throwing their money away. I mean, since even the late 19th century in Egypt, people have been saying that people were really throwing their money away on these nightclubs, and also there was gambling in the area. So there was the usual moralistic objections. Largely, I would say, not specifically religious in justification, although obviously there's some kind of, you know, the morals are in some way based on religion, but broadly speaking, it was more about what this was doing to the new independent country, which everyone thought was going to be great. And now look, its youth are being cast aside. So there's that, which you would expect. But also, I mean, if you were to look at it from a perspective of these women who were performing, there's a lot of danger. I mean, one of the stories that I go into a little in the book is the story of Imtiazel Fawzi, who is a woman who actually started her career in Badia Mosabni's nightclubs, like so many women did, moved up a little bit, managed to get a couple of little film roles, then decided in the mid-1930s to open her own nightclub, which she did with another woman, Mary Mansour. And together, they sort of were going reasonably well until this man from a local gang. In almost every area in Cairo, there were these kind of strong man, these gangs all clustered around a sort of central strong man, which ran a kind of protection racket. Anyway, one of these gangs went to Imtiazel Fawzi and said, pay us money, essentially, or, you know, things might get difficult for you. And she refused quite bravely, or perhaps she didn't even have the money, it's hard to say. And the gang then escalated things, and it all eventually ended in her being murdered in the middle of one of her nightclub acts.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And then they're staying in the Savoy Hotel in London, and on a stormy night it was even, she murders him, she shoots him in the Savoy. He sort of stumbles out into the corridor and is discovered.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down. And learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
The women involved in this scene, they had to walk quite a difficult tightrope, didn't they? Because on the one hand, they were deemed morally lax, or some people deemed them so. On the other hand, they were glorified and idolized as celebrities, which is quite a strange tension at play there, isn't it?
Yeah. And some of the women really kind of exploited that tension. I mean, I think probably my favorite woman in the book, although hard to pick just one, is Munir al-Mahdaya. She managed to create this kind of celebrity persona, which played with these things, with this, like, with the moral laxity that people were condemning, but also were quite drawn to, obviously, and managed to get herself into the press and extremely popular. And she would kind of hold these big parties on her houseboat, which became very famous, which, you know, these wild parties. There were always rumors that she was having affairs with such man or another. And you kind of get the feeling that she was playing them up a little bit. She would send all these pictures of herself into the press, pictures of her dressing up as a man. She liked to do that.
The notoriety brought more publicity, right?
Yeah, that's certainly how I read it. And she's kind of playing with that a little bit. And she has these close relationships with people in the press and asks them to plant stories.
And if I'm right, she was also a pioneer of Arabic opera as we would imagine it, or was it a different kind of genre?
I mean it's a version of Carmen, which is an opera that we know, and it's Arabic theater had always really included singing, because that's obviously what the audiences wanted, and even before the 1920s the great theatre stars were also great singing stars. And this one guy in the late 19th century, Salema Hegazi, he was called, was famous more for his singing than his acting, really. And he tried to put on a version of Hamlet in which he didn't sing. And the audience then all complained and kept chanting until they forced him to put some songs into Hamlet, because that's what people had gone for. So there's always this big musical element to Arabic theatre. And Munir al-Mahdaya, so she started off as a nightclub singer in the 1905-ish, before she went into theatre at all. And she really goes into theatre in the 1910s, because all of the nightclubs in Egypt really get shut down, or most of them, during the war by the British. So she brings in this singing, sort of nightclub singing, onto the stage. So it sort of makes sense for her, if she's going to perform a play, to do one with songs in, and therefore to do an opera. And she obviously hit on Carmen. She quite liked it. Big, strong central female role. It's probably appealing. Chance to do some dancing. She was famous for having, like, very extravagant costumes. So there was also a chance to put some of that in it. And so managed to do a version of that in which she sort of mixed Arabic music. She'd hired a composer to kind of create this hybrid of the original with Arabic stylings. And it was hugely popular. I mean, shows sold out. The newspaper reports that people would fight each other to get to their seats.
You mentioned earlier how she was really good at courting the press. And one of the other women that you talk about is a actor called Rose Al-Youssef, who founded a magazine, which I love, that she just called Rose Al-Youssef. She called it after herself. How important was the media in generating these celebrities, and what kind of stuff did it report on, for example?
The media is one of my main sources of information, because in the mid-1920s, as this theatre is booming, so is the press. And, like, everyone who can is starting up their own little magazine. And they're usually extremely focused on the women of Cairo's nightlife. I mean, there are gossipy stories about men, but many, many fewer than there are about women. And they're kind of obsessed with all the minutiae of actresses and singers' lives. So they run these features like, oh, what do our actresses and singers eat for breakfast? How do they answer the telephone? They actually give out some actresses' telephone numbers, which seems a bit, just print them in the newspapers. And they have these features where they go around to their house and take photos in their house and ask them about their sort of day-to-day life and careers. So people are really obsessed with knowing about the minutiae of the private lives of actresses and singers particularly.
So it's very much a celebrity culture that we would recognise today.
Yeah, no, definitely. The kind of real birth of celebrity culture in Egypt, which came at this great confluence of newly independent state, new burgeoning nightclub scene and burgeoning press. But Rosal Youssef really played, I mean, did something, you know, extraordinary by looking at what was going on with the theatre press and saying, this isn't great. One, she was attacked quite a lot herself in the theatre press, but also just, you know, she saw the newspapers and the magazines not really treating performance as a serious art, and she wanted to change that. So in order to do that, she started her own magazine and really kind of, she seized the means of production in a way that no one before her had.
You mentioned earlier somebody being murdered offstage, but what were some of the other offstage scandals that rocked this world?
One very big scandal of the 1920s that ties in strange ways to the theatre world is that of Ali Fahmy and his wife, Marguerite Alibert. Now, Ali Fahmy is this aristocratic Egyptian from a very important family, sort of young playboy type, very rich, early 20s, spends a lot of time in Cairo's nightlife, kind of throwing the money around, manages to meet this French woman called Marguerite Alibert, and they get married. It turns out to be an extremely unpleasant marriage. They don't get along. There's an insinuation, as we'll go to later on, that he's maybe abusive. And then they're staying in the Savoy Hotel in London. And on a stormy night, it was even, she murders him. She shoots him in the Savoy. He sort of stumbles out into the corridor and is discovered. Then there's this huge court case in London in which she says it's self-defense, says that he's abusive, that she killed him in self-defense, which the jury agrees with. And in Egypt, though, this becomes a huge scandal because a lot of the her defense focuses on the fact that he is this Oriental, quote-unquote, man, and kind of plays up these stereotypes a lot of people have about Egyptians, and Egyptians in Egypt notice this and don't take very kindly to it. What then happens a few years later is that one of the great stars of Egypt theatre, Yusuf Wahbi, marries Ali Fahmy's sister, moves into her huge villa in a very fancy area of Cairo. And so he claims, discovers in one of the chest of drawers, letters from a lover to Marguerite Alibert. And so the implication is that she is being unfaithful to Ali Fahmy. And he is, in his own memoirs, he says he's scandalized by it, that she could do this. And he ends up writing a play about the whole event, which sort of basically the message of which is Egyptian men don't marry foreign women, which then goes on to be turned into the first Arabic talking movie. Because in the 20s and 30s, the film business is also really coming up. And in the early 30s, everyone's racing to make the first Arabic talkie. And it's Yusuf Wahbi who does this, eventually based with a film that's based on a play that's based on this huge scandal of the early 1920s.
It's very complex. So in terms of that connection between Arabic, Egyptian, and kind of international people, were most of the women who were the cornerstones of this Cairo scene, were they Egyptian?
Yes. I mean, all of the women I look at in the book are Arabic-speaking, They're not all Egyptian. So Badia Masamli, for instance, is from Damascus. Reza Yousef actually also grew up in Lebanon. But they are all Arabic speaking. And sort of one of the things I'm trying to show in this book is that there is a cosmopolitan world that includes people from Europe and from Arabic-speaking countries, all sort of working together in these nightclubs. Because there's often a sense when telling the story of cosmopolitan Alexandria, for instance, that it's a very segregated kind of world. So you had Brits who would only hang out with sort of other Brits and Europeans, and then you would have a sort of, you know, the quote-unquote, what people used to call the native city, who they wouldn't sort of interact with. But what you see going on in Cairo is everyone really together on the nightclub scene. There was this genre of theatre that also grew in the 1920s called Franco-Arab Revue, in which the performances were done in this mix of languages. There would be Arabic, but then also there would be a song in French by a touring French singer, or you know, parts of the plays would be in Arabic. There would be these kind of vaudeville plays with sort of comic farces, and they were all, everything was coming together in this kind of at least less segregated atmosphere than people are used to seeing.
Mm. So with all the women that you look at, they became successful. And do you get any sense of what the secrets of their success were? Was it different for each woman, or were there certain things that really struck a chord with you know, audiences at the time?
One of the common denominators for all of them is that they're extremely good at not just at performing, but at managing their careers. I mean, Badia Masamli is a good example of that, that she made sure to have a stake in her own nightclub, you know, to run it. And the same is kind of true for Munir al-Mahdeya as well. And the great singer of Egypt in the 20th century, Umm Kulthum, is also coming up at this time. I mean, she is remembered as the sort of big Arabic star in the 50s and 60s. But this is the time when her career begins. And she is extremely good at cutting her own deals with record companies. And it's this fact that they're, you know, that a lot of these stars are making their own money that allows them to have these long careers and be successful. So it's not only a matter of talent. I mean, there are lots of talented women who kind of fell by the wayside. It's a matter of combining the talent with business savvy.
On Umm Kulthum, who you just mentioned there, she was interesting, wasn't she? Because she kind of built herself this backstory about being a very wholesome, moral country girl, essentially. Do you think that was part of the reason for her success?
Yeah, she really had the complete opposite approach to the press that Munir al-Mahdeya had. So Munir al-Mahdeya was throwing her house parties, you know, having affairs, planting stories in the press, living this kind of consciously subversive life. Whereas Umm Kulthum was the total opposite. One, she kind of barely spoke to the press. She built this kind of wall around her private life. And when she did speak to the press, it was always to, present a kind of wholesome image of herself as slightly different from the rest of the other nightclub singers. You know, not quite like them. I mean, although still she was still criticized by some people for being too salacious, but her own approach was to very carefully stage manage this quite wholesome image. And I think, I mean, it's unclear to say whether that made her more popular at the time, but I think what has happened subsequently is she has risen above everyone else in the kind of public consciousness, because maybe once the sort of fun and the excitement of the nightlife sort of goes away, you know, once people's careers are over, then maybe it's a story of being morally upright that kind of keeps you as a national icon.
So on that note of the party being over, how did this scene come to an end, really?
In many ways, it's still continues, although not, I mean, in the same venues and not exactly the same shows, but there's still a tradition of dance in Egypt, which keeps going. You know, we've got a lot of dancers now have Instagram accounts and post videos and perform in nightclubs. But yeah, this golden age fizzled away as, I mean, a variety of reasons. One reason is simply that film came to replace a lot of this stuff. So people weren't going out to nightclubs and theatres as much because they were going to the cinemas instead. But another big reason is in the 1950s, there's the Free Officers Revolution and NASA comes to power. And Egypt, a lot of the foreigners who made up large parts of the performers, as well as, you know, much of the audiences of some of these shows, left Egypt, really. And so part of that, the cosmopolitan scene that we've been talking about, fades away.
Mm. So I think for my final question, I just wanted to ask you how looking at this nightlife scene and the women that dominated it gives us a different perspective on this era of Egypt's past.
I would say that one thing I was trying to do with this book is to look at the Middle East from a different way to how we see it more generally, not only Egypt in the 1920s, but I mean, it strikes me when you go into a bookshop in the UK, you go to the Middle East section and it's very much politics, war, sort of how to solve Israel-Palestine or that kind of thing. And you don't really get a sense of what the culture of the Middle East is like and what, in fact, people are really interested in. I mean, I think in Egypt, there's still a lot of people are interested in this period, and the interest is growing now. Even in the past 10 years, there's been a kind of uptick of people looking back to this period. So, yeah, what I try to do is write a book that could mean something both to an Egyptian audience and to a Western audience at the same time, and not just through the lens of seeing the Middle East as a problem, which I think a lot of books do, and not just through the lens of a very male-dominated high politics.
That was Raphael Cormack. His book, Midnight in Cairo, The Female Stars of Egypt's Roaring Twenties, is out now, published by Saki. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Collins.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.